Gardin's Steelyard. 1. A rule of thumb attributed to Fra Gardin, -1110 to -1063, stating that when one is comparing two hypotheses, they should be placed on the arms of a metaphorical steelyard, a kind of primitive scale consisting of an arm free to pivot around a central fulcrum, and preference given to the one that rises higher, presumably because it weighs less. The upshot being that simpler, more lightweight hypotheses are preferable to those that are heavier, i.e. more complex, also referred to as Saint Gardin's Steelyard, or simply the Steelyard. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Very comfortable, as I saw when I came up the steps and pushed the door open, again fighting the sense that I was a trespasser. ROF carpenters had been at work furnishing the stone shelf with wooden floors and paneled walls. Actually, cabinet makers was a fairer description than carpenters for a vout who chose woodworking as their avocation, and so the place was all fitted and joined to tolerances that Cord might have envied. It was mostly one great cubicle room, 10 paces square, and lined with books. To my right, a fire burned on a hearth. To my left, clear northern skylight rushed in through a bay window so large that it formed a sort of alcove, as broad, round, and comfortable as Archibald, who sat in the middle of it, reading a book so ancient he had to handle the pages with tongs. So he had not seen me tree climbing after all. I could have slunk away. But now I was glad I hadn't. It was good to see him here. "You could be Shuf himself," I said.
"Shh,"
he commanded, and looked about the place.
"People will be cross if you talk that way. All the orders must have their special hideaways. Islands of luxury that must make Saint Cardis roll over in her chalcedony sarcophagus. Pretty luxurious that, come to think of it. Come off it, as cold as hell in the winter. Hence the expression, cold as Cardis's."
"Shush," he said again. "You know, Archibald, if the Adharian chapter has a luxurious hideaway, they've yet to show it to me."
"They are the odd ones out,"
he said, rolling his eyes. He looked me up and down.
"Perhaps when you have attained more seniority—"
"Well, what are you, at the age of 19?
The FAE of the reformed old Fonians? The chapter and I have become most comfortable with each other in, yes, a short time. They support my project."
"What? Reconciling us with the Diolaters?
Some of the reformed old Fonians even believe in God."
"Do you, Archibald?"
All right,"
I added, for he was getting ready to shush me for a third time. He finally began to move. He took me on a little tour, showing me some of the artifacts of the Dowman's halcyon days, gold drinking cups and jeweled book covers now preserved under glass. I accused his order of having more of the same hidden away somewhere for drinking out of, and he blushed. Then, as all this discussion of utensils had put him in mind of food, he shelved his book. We left Shuf's dowman behind us and began walking back for the midday meal. We had both skipped provender, a luxury that was possible only because some younger fras had begun to spell us, winding the clock a few days a week. When we gave up altogether on clock winding, which would happen in 2 or 3 years, each of us would have enough free time to settle on an avocation, something practical that one could do to help improve life at the consent. Between now and then, we had the luxury of trying different things just to see how we liked them. Fra Orlo, for example, and his ongoing conversation with the library grape. We were too far north. The grapes were not happy, but we did have a south-facing slope between the page trees and the outer wall of the consent where they deigned to grow.
"Beekeeping," Archibald said when I asked him what he was interested in.
I laughed at the image of Archibald enveloped in a cloud of bees. "I always thought you'd end up doing indoor work," I said, "on dead things. I thought you'd be a bookbinder."
"At this time of year, beekeeping is indoor work on dead things," he pointed out. "Perhaps when the bees come out of hibernation, I won't favor it so much. How about you, Fra Erasmus?"
Though Archibald didn't know it, this was a sensitive subject. There was another reason you needed an avocation, so that if you turned out to be incapable of doing anything else, you could give up on books and chalk halls and dialogue and work as a sort of laborer for the rest of your life. It was called falling back. There were plenty of avowed like that, making food, brewing beer, and carving stone, and it was no secret who they were. Well, you can pick some funny thing like beekeeping, I pointed out, and it'll never be anything more than an eccentric hobby, because you'll never need to fall back. Not unless the ROF suddenly recruits a whole lot of geniuses. For me, the odds of falling back are a little greater, and I need to pick something I could actually do for 80 years without going crazy. Archibald now blew an opportunity to assure me that I was really smart and this would never happen. I didn't mind. After my rough conversation with Tullia 6 weeks ago, I was spending less time agonizing and more time trying to get things accomplished. There are some opportunities, I told him, making the instruments on the Starhenge work the way they're supposed to. Those opportunities would be much brighter if you in fact had access to the Starhenge, he pointed out. It was safe for him to talk this way since we were sloshing through leaves and no one was near us, unless Sora Trestinus was hiding in a leaf pile with a hand cupped to her ear. I stopped and raised my chin.
Are you expecting an Inquisitor to fall out of a tree? Archibald asked me.
No, just looking at it, I said, referring to the Starhenge. From here, on this little rise, we had a good view of it. But nestled as we were in the coppice, we'd be difficult to make out from the minster, and so I felt comfortable taking a long look. The twin telescopes of Sant Mithra and Mylax were in the same position where they had rested during the 3 months or so we'd been locked out, slewed around to aim at the northern sky. I was thinking that if Orlo was using the M&M to look at something they didn't want him to see, then we might get some clues from where he pointed it the last day he had access to it. Maybe he even took some pictures that night, yet to be seen.
Can you draw any conclusions from where the M&M is pointed now? Archibald asked.
Only that Orlo wanted to look at something above the pole.
And what is above the pole, other than the pole star?
That's just it, I said. Nothing.
What do you mean? There must be something.
But it messes up my hypothesis.
What, pray tell, is that? And can you explain it as we walk toward a place that is warm and has food?
I started moving my feet again and talked to the back of Archibald's head as I let him break trail through the leaves. I had been guessing it was a rock.
Meaning an asteroid,
he said. Yeah, but rocks don't come over the pole.
How can you say such a thing? Don't they come from all directions?
Yeah, but they mostly have low inclinations. They are in the same plane as the planets, so you'd look near the ecliptic, which is what we call that plane.
But that is a statistical argument, he pointed out. It could simply be an unusual rock.
It fails the Steelyard.
Sant Gaudens Steelyard is a useful guideline. All sorts of real things fail it, Archibald pointed out, including you and me.
Orlo sat with us. It was the first time I had talked to him in ages. He sat where he could gaze out a window at the mountains in much the same mood as I'd been looking at the Starhenge a few minutes earlier. It was a clear day and the peaks were all standing out, seeming as if they were close enough to throw stones at. I wonder what the seeing will be like tonight on top of Bly's Butte, he sighed.
Better than here, anyway.
Is that the one where the Slines ate Saint Bly's liver? I asked.
The same.
Is that around here? I thought it was on another continent or something.
Oh, no. Bly was a Saint Edhar man. You can look it up in the Chronicle. We have all of his relics salted away somewhere.
Do you really mean to suggest that there's an observatory there? Or are you just pulling my leg?
Orlo shrugged.
I've no idea. Estimard built a telescope there after he renounced his vow and stormed out the day gate.
And Estimard is?
One of my two teachers. Paphlagon being the other? Yes. They both got fed up with this place at about the same time. Estimard left. Paphlagon went into the upper labyrinth one night after supper, and then I didn't see him for a quarter of a century until, Well, you know. A thought occurred to him. What were you doing during Paphlagon's voco? At the time, you were still a guest of Antenestra.
Antenestra was a figure of ancient mythology who had crept up on her father as he lay sleeping and put out his eyes. I had never heard Suetrestinus referred to this way. I bit my lip and shook my head in dismay as Arcibald blew soup out his nostrils.
That is not fair, I said. She's only following orders.
Orlo squared off to plain me.
You know, during the Third Harbinger, it was quite common for those who had committed terrible crimes to say
that they were just following orders. We all know that.
Fra Erasmus is suffering from St. Alvar syndrome, Arcibald said.
Those people during the Third Harbinger were shoving children into furnaces with bulldozers, I said. And as far as St. Alvar goes, well, he was the sole survivor of his consent in the Third Sack and was held captive for 3 decades. Locking the door to the telescopes for a few weeks doesn't really measure up, does it?
Orlo conceded the point with a wink. My question stands. What did you do during voco?
Of course, I'd have loved to tell him. So I did, but I made it into a joke. While no one was looking, I ran up to the Starhenge to make observations. Unfortunately, the sun was out.
That damned luminous orb,
Orlo spat. Then something crossed his mind. But you know that our equipment can see some things during the daytime if they are very bright. Since Orlo had decided to play along with my joke, it would not have been sporting for me to drop it at this point. Unfortunately, the M&M was pointed in the wrong direction, I said.
I didn't have time to slew it around. The wrong direction for what?
Orlo asked.
For looking at anything bright, such as a planet or...
I faltered. Jezri sat down at an empty table nearby, facing me and Orlo, and remained still, ignoring his food. If he'd been a wolf, his ears would have been erect and swiveled toward us.
Orlo said, Would it be too much trouble for you to bring your sentence to a decent conclusion?
Arcibald looked as rattled as I felt. This had started as a joke. Now Fra Orlo was trying to get at something serious, but we couldn't make out what.
Aside from supernovae, very bright objects tend to be nearby within the solar system, and things in the solar system are, by and large, confined to the plane of the ecliptic. So, Fra Orlo, in this absurd fantasy of me running to the Starhenge to look at the sky in broad daylight, I'd have to slew the M&M from its current polar orientation to the plane of the ecliptic in order to have a chance of actually seeing anything.
I just want your absurd fantasy to be internally consistent,
Fra Orlo explained.
Well, are you happy with it now?
He shrugged.
Your point is well reasoned. But don't be too dismissive of the poles. Many things converge there.
Like what? Lines of longitude? I scoffed. Arcibald, in similar spirit.
Migratory birds.
Jezri.
Compass needles?
Then a higher-pitched voice broke in.
Polar orbits!
We turned and saw Barb coming toward us with a tray of food. He must have been listening with one ear as he stood in line. Now he was giving the answer to the riddle in a pre-adolescent voice that could have been heard from Bly's Butte. It was such an odd thing to say that it had turned heads all over the refectory.
By definition, he continued, in the sing-song voice he used when he was rattling off something he had memorized from a book, a satellite in a polar orbit must cross over each of the poles during each revolution around Arbra.
Orlo stuffed a piece of gravy-sopped bread into his mouth to hide his amusement. Barb was now standing right next to me with his tray a few inches from my ear, but he made no move to sit down. I had the feeling I was being watched. I looked over Fra Corlandon a few tables distant, just in the act of glancing away. But he could still hear Barb.
A telescope aimed north would have a high probability of detecting...
I yanked down on a loose fold of his bolt. One arm dropped. All the food slid to that end of his tray and threw it out of balance. He lost control and it all avalanched to the floor. All heads turned our way. Barb stood amazed. "My arm was acted on by a force of unknown origin," he stated.
"Terribly sorry, it was my fault," I said.
Barb was fascinated by the mess on the floor. Knowing by now how his mind worked, I rose, squared off in front of him, and put my hands on his shoulders.
"Barb, look at me," I said.
He looked at me.
"This was my fault. I got tangled up with your bolt."
"You should clean it up if it was your fault," he said matter-of-factly.
"I agree, and that is what I shall do now," I said. I went off to fetch a bucket. Behind me, I could hear Jezri asking Barb a question about conic sections.
Kalka. 1. In Proto and Old Orth, chalk, or any other such substance used to make marks on hard surfaces. 2. In Middle and Later Orth, a calculation, especially one that consumes a large amount of chalk because of its tedious and detailed nature. 3. In Praxic and Later Orth, an explanation, definition, or lesson that is instrumental in developing some larger theme, but that, because of its overly technical, long-winded, or recondite nature, has been moved aside from the main body of the dialogue and encapsulated in a footnote or appendix so as not to divert attention from the main line of the argument. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
One form of drudgery led straight into another as Sur Ayla helpfully reminded me that it was my day to clean up the kitchen following the midday meal. I hadn't been at it for long before I noticed that Barb was in there with me, just following me around, making no move to help, which irked me at first. Yet another case of his almost perfect social cluelessness. But once I got over that, I decided it was better that way. Some things were easier to do alone. Communicating and coordinating with others was often more trouble than it was worth. Many tried to help anyway because they thought it was the polite thing to do or because it was an avenue for social bonding. Barb's thinking wasn't muddled by any such considerations. Instead, he talked to me, which, in my view, was preferable to being helped.
"Orbits are about as much fun as what you are doing," he observed gravely, watching me get down on my knees and reach elbow deep into a grease-choked drain.
"I gather that Grand Sewer Alma has been teaching you about such things," I grunted.
Drain cleaning made it easy to hide my chagrin. I hadn't learned about orbits until my second year. This was Barb's second month.
"A lot of X's and Y's and Z's," he exclaimed,
which forced a laugh out of me.
"Yes," I said. "Quite a few."
"You want to know what's stupid?"
"Sure, Barb. Lay it on me," I said,
hauling a fistful of vegetable trimmings up out of the drain against the back pressure of 20 gallons of dammed-up dishwater. The drain gargled and began to empty.
"Any slime could stand out on the meadow at night and see some satellites in polar orbits and other satellites in orbits around the equator and know that those were two different kinds of orbits," he exclaimed. "But if you work out the X's and Y's and Z's of it, guess what?"
"What?"
"They just look like a lot of X's and Y's and Z's, and it is not as obvious that some are polar and some are equatorial as it would be to any dumb old slime looking up into the sky."
"Worse than that," I pointed out. "Staring at the X's and Y's and Z's doesn't even tell you that they are orbits."
"What do you mean?"
"An orbit is a stationary, stable thing," I said. "The satellite's moving all the time, of course, but always in the same way. But that kind of stability is in no way shown by the X's and Y's and Z's."
"Yeah, it's like knowing all of the theorics only makes us stupider,"
he laughed excitedly and cast a theatrical glance over his shoulder as if he were up to something incredibly mischievous.
"Alma's having you work it out in the most gruesome way possible," I said, "using Saint Lesper's coordinates, so that when she teaches you how it's really done, it'll seem that much easier."
Barb was dumbfounded. I went on.
"Like hitting yourself in the head with a hammer. It feels so good when you stop."
This was the oldest joke in the world, but Barb hadn't heard it before, and he became so amused that he got physically excited and had to run back and forth across the kitchen several times to flame off energy. A few weeks ago, I would have been alarmed by this and would have tried to calm him down, but now I was used to it and knew that if I approached him physically, things would get much worse.
What's the right way to do it?
Orbital elements, I said. 6 numbers that tell you everything that can be known about how a satellite is moving.
But I already have those 6 numbers.
What are they? I asked, testing him.
The satellite's position on Saint-Lesprit's X, Y, and Z axes. That's 3 numbers. And its velocity along each one of those axes. That's 3 more. 6 numbers.
But as you pointed out, you can look at those 6 numbers and still not be able to visualize the orbit, or even know that it is an orbit. What I am telling you is that with some more theorics, you can turn them into a different list of 6 numbers, the orbital elements, that are infinitely easier to work with, in that you can glance at them and know right away whether the orbit goes over the poles or around the equator.
Why didn't Grand Sir Alma tell me that to begin with?
I couldn't tell him because you learned too damned fast. But if I tried to be overly diplomatic, Barb would see through it and plane me. Then I had an upside. It was my responsibility, just as much as it was Alma's, to teach Fids the right stuff at the right time. You are now ready to stop working in Saint-Lesprit's coordinates, I announced, and begin working in other kinds of spaces, the way real grown-up Theors do.
Is this like parallel dimensions?
Said Barb, who apparently had been watching the same kinds of spielies as I had before coming here. No, these spaces I'm talking about aren't like physical spaces that you can measure with a ruler and move around in. They are abstract theoretical spaces that follow different rules called action principles. The space that cosmographers like to use has 6 dimensions, one for each of the orbital elements. But that's a special purpose tool, only used in that discipline. A more general one was developed early in the Praxic Age by Saint-Hemn. And I went on to give Barb a calca about Hemn spaces, or configuration spaces, which Hemn had invented when he, like Barb, had become sick of X's and Y's and Z's.
To go 100. 1. Derogatory slang. To lose one's mind, to become mentally unsound, to stray irredeemably from the path of theorics. The expression can be traced to the 3rd centennial apert, when the gates of several hundreder maths opened to reveal startling outcomes, e.g., at Saint Rambolf's, a mass suicide that had taken place only moments earlier. At Saint Terramore's, nothing at all, not even human remains. At Saint Beedle's, a previously unheard-of religious sect calling themselves the Matterites, still in existence. At Saint Lesper's, no humans, but a previously undiscovered species of tree-dwelling higher primates. At Saint Fendra's, a crude nuclear reactor in a system of subterranean catacombs. These and other mishaps prompted the creation of the Inquisition and the institution of hierarchs in their modern forms, including wardens regulant, with power to inspect and impose discipline in all maths. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I caught up with Frau Orlo late in the afternoon as he was coming out of a chalk hall, and we stood among page-stuffed pigeonholes and chatted. I knew better than to ask him what he had been getting at earlier with his weird discussion of daytime cosmography. Once he had made up his mind to teach us in that mode, there was no way to get him to say the answer straight out. Anyway, I was more worried about the things he had been referring to earlier. Listen, you're not thinking of leaving, are you? He got a slightly amused look, but said nothing. I always worried you were going to go into the labyrinth and become a hundreder. That would be bad enough, but the way you were talking, I got the idea you were going to become a pharaoh like Estermard. This was Orlo's idea of an answer.
What does it mean that you worry so much?
I sighed.
Describe worrying, he went on.
What?
Pretend I'm someone who has never worried. I'm mystified. I don't get it. Tell me how to worry.
Well, I guess the first step is to envision a sequence of events as they might play out in the future.
But I do that all the time, and yet I don't worry.
It is a sequence of events with a bad end.
So you're worried that a pink dragon will fly over the continent and fart nerve gas on us?
No, I said with a nervous chuckle. I don't get it, Orlo claimed, deadpan. That is a sequence of events with a bad end. But it's nonsensical. There are no nerve gas farting pink dragons. Fine, he said. A blue one, then. Jessery had wandered by and noticed that Orlo and I were in dialogue, so he approached, but not too close, and took up a spectator's position, hands folded in his bolt, chin down, not making eye contact. It has nothing to do with the dragon's color, I protested. Nerve gas farting dragons don't exist. How do you know? One has never been seen. But I have never been seen to leave the consent, yet you worry about that. All right. Correction. The whole idea of such a dragon is incoherent. There are no evolutionary precedents. Probably no metabolic pathways anywhere in nature that could generate nerve gas. Animals that large can't fly because of basic scaling laws, and so on. All sorts of reasons from biology, chemistry, theorics. I suppose then that the slines, who know nothing of such matters, must worry about pink nerve gas farting dragons all the time. You could probably talk them into worrying about it. But no, there's some kind of filter that kicks in. I pondered it for a moment and shot a glance at Jessery, inviting him to join us. After a few moments, he took his hands out of his cloak and stepped forward. If you worried about pink ones, he pointed out, you'd have to worry about blue, green, black, spotted, and striped ones. And not just nerve gas farters, but bomb droppers and fire belchers. Not just dragons, but worms, giant turtles, lizards, I added. And not just physical entities, but gods, spirits, and so on, Jessery said. As soon as you open the door wide enough to admit pink nerve gas farting dragons, you have let in all of the other possibilities as well. Why not worry about all of them, then? Asked Fra Orlo.
I do,
claimed Arcibald, who had seen us talking and come over to find out what was going on.
Fra Erasmus, said Orlo, you said a minute ago that it would be possible to talk slines into worrying about a pink nerve gas farting dragon. How would you go about it?
Well, I'm not a Prokian. But if I were, I suppose I'd tell the slines some sort of convincing story that explained where the dragons had come from, and at the end of it, they'd be plenty worried. But if Jessery burst in warning them about a striped fire-belching turtle, why, they'd cart him off to the loony bin. Everyone laughed, even Jessery, who, as a rule, didn't like jokes made at his expense.
What would make your story convincing? Orlo asked.
Well, it'd have to be internally consistent. And it would also have to be consistent with what every slime already knew of the real world.
How so?
Leo and Tullia were on their way to the refectory kitchen, where it was their turn to prepare dinner. Leo, having heard the last few lines, chimed in,
You could claim that shooting stars were dragon farts that had been lit on fire.
Very good, said Orlo.
Then, whenever a slime looked up and saw a shooting star, he'd think it was corroboration for the pink dragon myth.
And he could refute Jessery, Leo said, by saying, You idiot, what do striped fire-belching turtles have to do with shooting stars?
Everyone laughed again.
This is straight from the later writings of Saint Evanedric, Arcibald said.
Everyone got quiet. We had thought we were just being playful, until now.
Fra Arcibald is jumping ahead, Orlo said, in a tone of mild protest.
Evanedric was a Theor, Jessery pointed out. This isn't the kind of stuff he would have written about.
On the contrary,
Arcibald said, squaring off.
Later in his life, after the reconstitution, he—
If you don't mind, Orlo said.
Of course not, said Arcibald.
Restricting ourselves to nerve gas farting dragons, how many colors do you think we could distinguish?
Opinions varied between 8 and 100. Tullia thought she could distinguish more, Leo fewer.
Well, say 10, Orlo said. Now let us allow for striped dragons with alternating colors.
Then there would be 100 combinations, I said.
90,
Jessery corrected me. You can't count red, red, and so on.
Allowing for different stripe widths, could we get it up to 1,000 distinguishable combinations? Orlo asked.
There was general agreement that we could.
Now move on to spots, plaids,
combinations of spots, plaids, and stripes. Hundreds of thousands, millions, different people were guessing.
And we are only considering nerve gas farting dragons so far,
Orlo reminded us. What of lizards, turtles, gods?
Hey, Jessrey exclaimed, and shot a glance at Arcibald.
This is becoming the kind of argument that a Theor would make.
How so, Fra Jessrey? Where is the theorical content?
In the numbers, Jessrey said, in the profusion of different scenarios.
Please explain.
Once you have opened the door to these hypotheticals that don't have to make internal sense, you quickly find yourself looking at a range of possibilities that might as well be infinitely numerous, Jessrey said. So the mind rejects them as being equally invalid and doesn't worry about them.
And this is true of Slines as well as of Saint Evanedric?
Arcibald asked.
It has to be, Jessrey said.
So it is an intrinsic feature of human consciousness, this filtering ability.
As Arcibald grew more confident, Jessrey, sensing he was being drawn into a trap, became more cautious.
Filtering ability? He asked.
Don't play stupid, Jessrey,
called Sura Ayla, who was also reporting for kitchen duty.
You just said yourself that the mind rejects and doesn't worry about the overwhelming majority of hypothetical scenarios. If that's not a filtering ability, I don't know what is.
Sorry,
Jessrey snapped back and looked around at me, Leo, and Arcibald as if he had just been mugged and needed witnesses.
What then is the criterion that the mind uses to select an infinitesimal minority of possible outcomes to worry about?
Orlo asked.
Plausibility? Possibility? People were murmuring, but no one seemed to feel confident enough to stake a claim.
Earlier, Fra Erasmus mentioned that it had something to do with being able to tell a coherent story.
It is a hem space, a configuration space argument, I blurted, before I'd even thought about it.
That's the connection to Evanedric the Theor.
Can you please explain? Orlo requested.
I wouldn't have been able to, if not for the fact that I had just been talking to Barb about it.
There's no way to get from the point in hemspace where we are now to one that includes pink nerve gas farting dragons following any plausible action principle, which is really just a technical term for there being a coherent story joining one moment to the next. If you simply throw action principles out the window, you're granting the world the freedom to wander anywhere in hemspace to any outcome without constraint. It becomes pretty meaningless. The mind, even the slime mind, knows that there is an action principle that governs how the world evolves from one moment to the next, that restricts our world's path to points that tell an internally consistent story. So it focuses its worrying on outcomes that are more plausible, such as you leaving.
You're leaving?
Tullia exclaimed, utterly horrified. Others who had joined the dialogue late reacted similarly. Orlo laughed, and I explained how the dialogue had gotten started, and I did it hastily before anyone could run off and start rumors.
I don't think you're wrong, Fra Erasmus, said Jessrey, when everyone had settled down. But I think you have a Steelyard problem. Bringing in hemspace and action principles seems like an unnecessarily heavyweight way of explaining the fact that the mind has an instinctive nose for which outcomes are plausible enough to worry about.
The point is conceded, I said. But Arcibald was crestfallen, disappointed in me for having backed down without a fight.
Remember that this came up in connection with Saint Evanedric, Arcibald said. A Theor who spent the first half of his life working rigorous calculations having to do with principles of action in various kinds of configuration spaces. I don't think he was merely speaking poetically when he suggested that human consciousness is capable of...
Don't go 100 on us now, Jessrey snorted.
Arcibald froze, mouth open, face turning red.
It is sufficient for now to have broached this topic, Orlo decreed. We'll not settle it here, not on empty stomachs anyway.
Taking the hint, Leo, Tullia, and Ayla took their leave, headed for the kitchen. Ayla shot a frosty look over her shoulder at Jessrey, then leaned in close to Tullia to make some remark. I knew exactly what she was complaining about. Jessrey had been the one who had brought up the profusion of outcomes argument in the first place, but when Arcibald had tried to develop it, he had gotten cold feet and backed out, even mocked Arcibald. Archibald wasn't happy about it either and began to pursue Jessery across the cloister, disputing the point.
Back to where we were, Orlo continued. Why do you worry so much, Erasmus? Are you doing nothing more productive than imagining pink nerve-gas-farting dragons? Or do you have a particular gift for tracing possible futures through hemmed space, tracing them, it seems, to disturbing conclusions?
You could help me answer that question, I pointed out, by telling me whether you are thinking of leaving.
I spent almost all of Apert extramuros, Orlo said with a sigh, as if he had finally been run to ground. I was expecting that it would be a wasteland, a cultural and intellectual charnel house. But that's not exactly what I found. I went to Spiele's. I enjoyed them. I went to bars and got into some reasonably interesting conversations with people. Slines. I liked them. Some were quite interesting, and I don't mean that in a bug-under-a-microscope way. They have stuck in my mind. Characters I'll always remember. For a while, I was quite seduced by it. Then one evening, I had an especially lively discussion with a Sline who was as bright as anyone within this consent. And somehow, toward the end, it came out that he believed that the sun revolved around Arb. I was flabbergasted, you know. I tried to disabuse him of this. He scoffed at my arguments. It made me remember just how much careful observation and theoretical work is necessary to prove something as basic as that Arb goes around the sun. How indebted we are to those who went before us. And this got me to thinking that I'd been living on the right side of the gate after all.
He paused for a moment, squinting off toward the mountains, as if judging whether he should go on to tell me the next part. Finally, he caught me giving him an expectant look and made a little gesture of surrender.
When I got back, I found a packet of old letters from Estimard, he said.
Really?
He'd been posting them from Bly's Butte once every year or so. Of course, he knew that they'd be impounded until the next Apert. He told me of some observations he had made, using a telescope he had built up there, grinding the mirror by hand and so forth. Good ideas, interesting reading. Certainly not the quality of work he had produced here, though.
But he was allowed to go up there,
I said, gesturing toward the Starhenge. Orlo thought that was funny.
Of course. And I trust that we shall be readmitted to it one day before too long.
Why? How? What basis do you have for that? I had to ask, though I knew he wouldn't answer.
Let us say I am too gifted with the faculty that you have for envisioning how things might play out.
Thanks a lot. Oh, and I can also put that faculty to work imagining what it would be like to be a feral, he said. Estimard's letters make it plain that this is a hard way to live.
Do you think he made the right choice?
I don't know, Orlo said, without hesitation. These are big questions. What does the human organism seek? Beyond food, water, shelter, and reproduction, I mean.
Happiness, I guess.
Which is something you can get in a shallow way simply by eating the food that they eat out there, Orlo pointed out. And yet still the people extramuros yearn for things. They join different kinds of arcs all the time. What's the point in that?
I thought about Jessery's family and mine.
I guess people like to think that they are not only living, but propagating their way of life.
That's right.
People have a need to feel that they are part of some sustainable project, something that will go on without them. It creates a feeling of stability. I believe that the need for that kind of stability is as basic and as desperate as some of the other more obvious needs. But there's more than one way to get it. We may not think much of the Sline subculture, but you have to admit, it's stable. Then the burgers have a completely different kind of stability.
As do we.
As do we. And yet it didn't work for Estimard. Perhaps he felt that living by himself on a butte would fill that need better.
Or maybe he just didn't need it as much as some of us, I suggested.
The clock chimed the hour. You're going to miss a fascinating talk by Sua Freta, Orlo said.
That sounded kind of like changing the subject, I pointed out.
Orlo shrugged. Subjects change. You'd best adapt.
Well, I said, all right, I'll go to her talk, but if you're going to leave, don't just walk out of this place without letting me know, please.
I promise to give you as much advance knowledge as I can if such a thing is going to happen, he said, in an indulgent tone as if talking to a mentally unhinged person.
Thank you, I said. Then I went to St. Grode's Chalk Hall and took a seat in the large empty space that, as usual, surrounded Barb. Technically, we were supposed to call him Fra Taverner now, for that was the name he had adopted when he had taken his vow, but some people took longer than others to grow into their avowed names. Archibald had been Archibald from day one. No one even remembered his extramural's name anymore, but people were going to be addressing Barb as Barb for a long time. Whatever his name, that boy was going to save me. There was a lot he didn't know, but nothing he was afraid to ask about, and ask about, and ask about, until he understood it perfectly. I decided to make him my fid. People would think I was doing it to be charitable. Maybe some would even think I was getting ready to fall back, and was making the care of Barb my avocation. Let them think so. In truth, it was mostly self-interest. I had learned more theorics in 6 weeks simply by being willing to sit next to Barb than I had in 6 months before Appert. I saw now that in my desire to know theorics, I had taken shortcuts that, just like shortcuts on a map, turned out to be long cuts. Whenever I had seen Jessery get it quicker than me, I had misread equations in a way that had seemed easier at the time but made things harder, no, impossible, later. Barb didn't have that fear that others were getting it faster. Because of how his brain was set up, he couldn't read that in their faces. And he did not have the same desire to reach a distant goal. He was altogether self-centered and short-sighted. He wanted only to understand this one problem or equation chalked on the slate before him now, today, whether or not it was convenient for the others around him. And he was willing to stand there asking questions about it through supper and past curfew. Come to think of it, Ayla and Tullia had come up with a similar way of learning a long time ago. The creature with two backs was a term Jessery had coined for those two girls when they stood together outside of a chalk hall discussing endlessly what they had just heard. It wasn't enough for one of them to understand something, nor for both of them to understand it in different ways. They both had to understand it in the same way. The sound of them furiously explaining things to each other gave the rest of us headaches. Especially when we'd been younger, we'd always clap our hands over our ears and run away when we spotted the creature with two backs. But it worked for them. Barb's willingness to do things the hard way in the near term was making his advancement toward the long goal, even though he didn't have one, swifter and surer than mine had ever been. And now I was advancing in step with him. As a possible avocation, I had been teaching the new crop how to sing. Extramuros, everyone heard music, but only a few actually knew how to make it. These new fids had to be taught everything. It was excruciating. I already knew this wasn't going to be my avocation. We met 3 afternoons a week in an alcove in what passed for our nave. One day as I was leaving one of these practices, I happened to run into Fra Leo, who was coming in to do whatever he did at the Warden Fendant's court.
Come up with me, he offered. I want to show you something.
A new nerve pinch?
No, nothing like that.
You know I'm not supposed to look out from the high levels.
Well, I haven't gone through hierarch training yet, so neither am I, he said. That's not what I want to show you.
So I began to follow him up the stair. As we climbed, I became nervous that he was going to carry out a plot to raid the Starhenge. Then I recalled what Orlo had said the other day about worrying too much and tried to put this out of my mind.
You're not supposed to look out beyond the walls,
he reminded me, as we were getting closer to the top of the southwest tower.
But you are allowed to remember what you saw there during Appert, right?
I suppose so.
Well, did you notice anything?
Say again?
Extramuros, did you notice anything?
What kind of a question is that? I noticed a ton of stuff, I sputtered. Leo turned around and gave me a brilliant smile, letting me know this was just his goofy sense of humor at work. Humor, Vlore. All right, I said. What was I supposed to notice?
Do you think the city's getting bigger or smaller?
Smaller, no question about it.
Why are you so sure? Did you look up the census data?
Another smile. Of course not. I don't know, just a feeling. Something about how the place looked.
How did it look?
Sort of weedy, overgrown. He turned around and held up his index finger like a statue of Telenes declaiming on the Pericline.
Hold that idea, he said, while we pass through enemy territory.
We looked at the closed and locked portcullis, but didn't say anything. We crossed the bridge into the Regulant Court and followed its inner walkway round to the stair that led up. When we had reached safe ground above, the statue of Amnectris, he said,
I was thinking of making gardening my avocation.
Well, considering all of the weeds you've pulled over the years doing penance for beating me up, you are well qualified, I said. But why on earth would you want to?
Let me show you what has been going on in the meadow, he said,
and led me out to the Fendant's ledge. A couple of sentinels were making the rounds, swathed in bulky winter bolts, their feet swallowed up in furry mucklucks. Leo and I were hot from climbing the stairs, and so the cold didn't bother us much. We took a moment to hood ourselves. This was a way of showing respect for the discipline. Our bolts, drawn far out in front of our faces, gave us tunnel vision. When we walked to the parapet and leaned forward, we could see down into the consent, but not up and out to the world beyond. Leo pointed down at the back fringe of the meadow. Shuf's dalment rose up just on the other side of the river. With the exception of a few evergreen shrubs, everything down there was dead and brown. It was easy to see that near the riverbank, the clover that carpeted most of the meadow became thin and patchy and blotched with darker, coarser stuff. Colonies of weeds that favored the sandy soil near the bank. Nearer the river, I could see a distinct front where the clover gave way altogether to a snarl of woody trash, slashberry and the like. Beyond that front, I could see splats and rambling trails of green. Some of the stuff back there was so tough that not even hard frost could kill it. I guess your theme today is weeds, but I don't see where you're going with it, I said.
Down there, come spring, I am going to stage a reenactment of the Battle of Trentai, he announced.
-1472, I answered in a robotic voice, that being one of the dates drilled into the head of every Fid.
And I suppose you want me to play the role of a hoplite who gets a Sarthian arrow in the ear? No thanks. He shook his head patiently.
Not with people, he said. With plants.
Say again?
I got the idea during Apert from seeing how weeds and even trees are invading the town, taking it back from humans so slowly that the humans don't notice. The meadow is going to represent the fertile plains of Thrania, the breadbasket of the Baesian Empire, Leo said. The river represents the River Contus, separating it from the northern provinces. By -1474, those have long since been lost to the horse archers. Only a few fortified outposts hold out against the barbarian tide.
Can we imagine that Shuf's dalment is one of those?
If you like. It doesn't matter. Anyway, during the cold winter of -1473, the steppe hordes, led by the Sarthian clan, crossed the frozen river and established bridgeheads on the Thrinian bank. By the time the campaigning season has opened, they've got three whole armies ready to break out. General Oxus deposes the Baesian Imperator in a military coup and marches forth, promising to drive the Sarthians into the river and drown them like rats. After weeks of maneuver, the legions of Oxus finally meet the Sarthians in the flat countryside near Trentai. The Sarthians stage a false retreat. Oxus falls for it like a total dumbass and charges into a pincer. He's surrounded, and 3 months later, Baz is on fire.
But how are you going to do all of that with weeds?
We'll allow the invasive species from the riverbank to make inroads into the clover. The star blossom vines run along the ground like light cavalry. It's incredible how fast they advance. The slashberry is slower but better at holding ground, like infantry. Finally, the trees come along and make it permanent. With a little weeding and pruning, we can make it all work out just like Trentai, except it'll take 6 months or so to play out.
This is the craziest idea I've ever heard, I said. You are some kind of a nut.
Would you rather help me, or go on trying to teach those brats down there how to carry a tune?
Is this a trick to get me to pull weeds?
No, we're going to let the weeds grow, remember?
What's going to happen after the weeds win? We can't set fire to the cloister. Maybe we could sack the apiary and drink all the mead.
Someone already did that during Appert,
he reminded me gravely.
No, we'll probably have to clean it all up. Though if people like it, we could let nature take its course and let a grove of trees grow on the conquered territory.
One of the things I like about this is that come summer, it will put me in a good position to watch Arcibald being chased around by angry swarms of bees, I said. Leo laughed. I thought to myself that his plan had another advantage as well. It was flagrantly silly. Until now, I had been dabbling in avocations, such as looking after Barb and teaching Fids how to sing, that were sensible and virtuous. Typical behavior for someone who was getting ready to fall back. To spend the summer doing something absolutely ridiculous would flaunt the fact that I had no such intentions. Those members of the Adharian chapter who hadn't wanted me would be furious. I'll do it, I said. But I guess we have to wait a few more weeks before anything starts to grow.
You're pretty good at drawing, aren't you?
Leo asked. Better than you, but that's not saying much. I can make technical illustrations. Barb is freakishly good at it. Why?
I was thinking we should make a record of it. Draw pictures of how it looks as the battle goes on. This would be an excellent vantage point.
Should I ask Barb if he's interested? Leo looked a little uneasy at that. Maybe because Barb could be so obnoxious. Probably because Barb was a new Fid and shouldn't have an avocation yet. Never mind, I'll do it myself, I said.
Great,
Leo said.
When can you start?
Leo and I read some histories of the Battle of Trentai during the next week and pounded stakes into the ground to mark important sites, such as where General Oxus, pierced by 8 arrows, had fallen on his sword. I constructed a rectangular frame about the size of a dinner tray with a grid of strings stretched across it. The idea was that I'd set this up on the parapet and look through it like a window frame as I sketched. If I continued to use it in the same way throughout the summer, then each illustration would tally with the next. One day, we'd be able to line them up in a row and then people would walk down the line and see the weed war unfold like a spiele. Leo spent a lot of time thrashing around in the brush along the riverbank, looking for particularly aggressive specimens of various kinds of weeds. Yellow star blossom was going to represent the Sarthian cavalry. Red and white, their allies. We were both waiting for the moment when we would get in trouble. Sure enough, a couple of weeks into the project, I looked up during supper to see Fra Spelican come into the refectory, accompanied by a younger hierarch of the regulant staff. Conversation dimmed for a moment, sort of like when the power threatens to go out and the room becomes brown. Spelican looked around the refectory until he found my face. Then, satisfied, he snatched up a tray and demanded some food. Hierarchs were allowed to dine with us, but they rarely did. They had to concentrate pretty fiercely not to let secular information slip out, and so this was no way to have a relaxing meal. Everyone had noticed the way Spelican had looked at me, and so, following the brownout, there was a brief, jovial uproar at my expense. For once in my life, I wasn't worried. What could they accuse me of? Conspiring to let weeds grow? Probably they had misinterpreted what Leo and I were up to. The only hard part was going to be explaining it to a man like Spelican. The younger hierarch, Rotha was her name, ate quickly, then rose and walked out of the refectory, hugging a fat wallet of papers that swiveled as her hips moved. Spelican ate more heartily, but refused offers of beer and wine. After a few minutes, he pushed back, wiped his lips, stood up, and came over to me.
"I wonder if I might have a word with you in St. Zenla's," he said.
"Certainly," I said, then glanced across the room at Leo, who was dining at another table. "Would you like Fra Leo to join us, or—"
"That will not be necessary," Spelican said.
which struck me as odd and left me with physical symptoms of anxiety, pounding heart, moist palms, as I followed Spellikin around the cloister to St. Zenla's. This was one of the smallest and oldest chalk halls, traditionally used by the most senior Adharian theoricians to collaborate or to teach their senior students. I'd only been in the room a couple of times my whole life and would never have dared to barge in there and claim it like this. It had one small table, large enough for at most four people to sit around it on their spheres. Rotha had already covered the table with stuff, a constellation of glow buds whose pools of soft light merged to illuminate a stack of blank leaves and a few manuscripts, or excerpts of them. Several pens lay in a neat row next to an uncapped ink bottle. "Interview with Fra Erasmus of the Adharian chapter of the Decenarian Math of the Consent of St. Edhar," Spellikon said. Rotha scribbled out a row of marks on a blank leaf, not the customary Bayesian characters, but a kind of shorthand that hierarchs were trained to use when taking down transcripts. Spellikon went on to tell the date and the time. I was mesmerized by Rotha's skill with the pen. Her hand swept across the whole width of the leaf in as little time as it took to draw breath, leaving in its wake a row of simple one-stroke glyphs that, it seemed to me, couldn't possibly convey as much meaning as the words we were speaking. My eyes wandered to the other manuscripts that Rotha had set out on the table. Most of them were also written in that same shorthand, but at least one was in traditional script. My script. Bending closer, I was able to make out several words. I recognized it as the journal I had started keeping when I had been in the penance cell in the Minster. I saw the names Fleck and Quinn and Orlo. My movements had gone all jerky. Some primitive threat response mechanism had taken over. Hey, that's mine! Spellikon saw to it that this was written down. The subject admits that document 11 is his. Where did you get that? I demanded, now sounding no older than Barb. Rotha's hand flitted across the leaf and immortalized it. From where it was, Spellikon answered, amused. You do know the whereabouts of your own journal, don't you? I thought I did. One of the niches outside of St. Grode's chalk hall, up high where only a few people could reach it. But to take someone else's leaves out of a niche was just about the rudest thing an avowed could do. It was only acceptable when someone had died or been thrown back. But, I went on, but you're not supposed to... Why don't you let me be the judge of what we are and are not supposed to do? Spellikon said. As he spoke these words, he made a gesture with his hand that stilled Rotha's hand, so none of it was written down. Then he made a different gesture that undid the spell, and she began to write again. This inquiry does not concern you directly, and, in fact, need not take up very much of your time. You have already supplied most of what we wish to know in the leaves of your journal. Clarification and confirmation are all that we require. On the day before Appert, did you serve as amanuensis during an interview conducted in the new library between Fra Orlo and an artisan from Extramuros named Quinn?
Yes.
Document 3, please, Spellikon said. Rotha drew out another manuscript, also written in my hand, my transcript of Orlo's interview with Quinn. I didn't bother asking where they had gotten it. Obviously, they'd been rooting around in Fra Orlo's niches, too. Outrageous. But for all that, I was beginning to relax. There was nothing wrong with the conversations Orlo had had with those artisans. Even if the Warden Regulant wouldn't take my word for it, well, others had been in the library the whole time and could vouch that it had all been harmless. This must be some petty and misguided harassment of Fra Orlo that would come to nothing, and I hoped, make Fra Spellikon look like an idiot. Spellikon had me confirm that document 3 was mine before going on. There are discrepancies between the account of the Orlo Quinn conversation as you transcribed it at the time and the version you later set down in your journal. Yes, I said. I'm not like her, I nodded at Rotha. I can't take shorthand. I only wrote down what was germane to the research that Orlo was doing.
Which research do you mean? Spellikon asked.
I thought that was obvious, but I explained. His study of the political climate extramuros, part of normal preparations for Appert.
Thank you. There are several such discrepancies, but I'd like to draw your attention to one late in the Quinn interview concerning the technical capabilities of Spiele captors.
This was so unexpected, it blanked my mind.
I vaguely remember that topic coming up. Your memory was not vague at all when you wrote this, he said, and reached down over Rotha's shoulder and picked up the journal. According to this, Artisan Quinn said at one point, and I quote, Fleck didn't make a Spiele. Does that make your memory any less vague?
Yes, the day before at Provener, we had sent Artisan Fleck to see the Eta so that they could show him to the north nave. Fleck wanted to make a Spiele, but later Quinn told us that it hadn't gone as planned. The Eta didn't allow Fleck to operate his Spiele captor in the Minster.
Why not?
The image quality was too good.
Too good in what way? Spelikon asked.
Quinn rattled off some commercial bullshit that I tried to capture in the journal, I said.
When you say you tried to capture it, are you saying that what you wrote in the journal is only a guess at what it said?
Here it reads, quoting again, The Eagle Res, the Steady Hand, the Dynazoom. Put those all together, and it could have seen straight across into the other parts of your Minster, even through the screens.
Did Quinn actually use those words?
I don't know. It's partly my recollection and partly an educated guess.
Explain what you mean by an educated guess in this case.
Well, the point of the story, the basic technical reason that the Eta wouldn't allow Fleck to use the Spiele captor, was that from where he was going to be sitting, behind the north screen, he would have been able to take pictures of the Thousanders and Hundreders by pointing his Spiele captor across the chancel. With our naked eyes, we can't see through the screens into the other naves because of the contrast between the screen, which is light-colored, cosmographers would say it has high albedo, and the dark space beyond, also because of distance and other factors. The gist of it was that the Eta had looked up the specifications on Fleck's Spiele captor and figured out that it had some combination of features that would make it possible to see things that the naked eye couldn't. Now, it's a fool's game trying to make sense of the commercial bullshit that the makers of Spiele captors used to describe those features, but from my experience with cosmography, I have a pretty good idea what it would entail. Some kind of zoom or magnification feature, a way of detecting faint images against a noisy background, and image stabilization to correct for shaking of the hands.
And that is what you mean by an educated guess, Spelikon said. Educated in the sense that anyone with a knowledge of cosmographical instruments would be able to infer what you inferred about the capabilities of Fleck's Spiele captor.
Yes.
It says in your journal, Spelikon continued, that Fra Orlo's hand came down on your wrist just after that and stopped you from writing. Why?
Being older and wiser, I said. Orlo saw where the conversation was headed. Quinn was about to go off chattering about secular stuff and about what had happened between Fleck and the Eta, which obviously is not the kind of information we ought to be exposed to.
But if your ears were going to be exposed to it anyway, why did Orlo stop your hand? Why did he not plug your ears?
I don't know. Maybe it wasn't the most logical thing for him to do. People don't always think clearly at such moments.
Except when they do, Spelikon said.
Well, at any rate, that is all I have for you concerning the Orlo Quinn interview. There is only one other question.
Yes? Where were you on the ninth night of Appert?
I thought for a minute and frowned. That's one of those simple-sounding questions that is hard for a normal person to answer. Spelikon was almost too quick to agree with me.
If by normal person you mean non-hierarch, then let me assure you I have no specific memories of what I did that evening.
Well, I was scheduled to give a tour the next morning, so I didn't stay up late. I had supper. Then I'm pretty sure I went to bed. I was doing a lot of thinking.
Really? Spelikon said. About what?
I must have gotten a very strange look on my face. He chuckled and said,
I'm just curious. I don't think it matters. He drew up another leaf. According to the Chronicle, on that night you were assigned to share a cell with Fra Branch and Fra Esteban. If I were to ask them, they'd both say you were in the cell with them that night. I can't imagine why they'd say anything else. Very well, Spellicon said. That will be all. Thank you for your time, Fra Erasmus.
Spellicon opened the cell door for me. I stepped through it to discover Fra Branch and Fra Esteban waiting in the gallery.